Well, I'd like to ask a question to begin the sermon today. It's often interesting to start with a question, and this is one you'll probably enjoy. Have you ever met an idiot? Okay, now you're all looking at me. Can you look at somebody else for a minute? No, I don't mean to imply anything, but have you ever met a fool? A yahoo? There's lots of different names for these kind of people. A bozo, a nitwit, a numbskull, a boneheaded individual. Ever met someone like that? Probably we all have. In fact, when I asked the first question, I saw in everyone's eyes the hint of recognition that absolutely I could name people by name. Today we're going to take a look at a story in the Bible of a real bonehead, a real numbskull, a real fool. Turn with me, if you would, to 1 Samuel chapter 25. It's the story of Nabal. Probably more accurately in the Hebrew, Naval is probably the better way to pronounce his name if we were to speak Hebrew. But we speak English, so we translate names into the way we can say them. So Nabal is what you're probably familiar with. We're going to take a look at Nabal to find out what lessons God may want us to understand based on the inclusion of his story in the scripture. Now, nothing is told to us about Nabal's parents. Nothing's told to us about his childhood. Was he raised by a couple of numbskulls? Chances are, yes, because they named him Nabal. Now, you're all familiar with the word Nabal means fool. Now again, maybe the culture in that part of southern Judea was like the urban culture in America today. Well, people say, hey, fool! And it's kind of a compliment. Somehow, though, I don't think that was the case back then. Maybe this was a nickname, that his real name was Howard or Bertrand or something, you know, Thurston, some erudite kind of name. And maybe it was just his nickname over the course of time. But the point is, his story is included here so that we can read through it and learn certain lessons that we would apply to ourselves. We don't just read this and point the finger and say, what a nutcase. What was he thinking? It's, boy, I need to reflect on this to see what I'm doing. Do I do things like this? So let's take a look in 1 Samuel chapter 25. In verse 1, Samuel died. Now, I've often wondered why that seems to be the introduction to this story. And my guess is that whatever governor, let's say, that Samuel was able to put upon Saul, now that Samuel dies, that governor is lost, that stopgap. You would think that since Samuel was the one that God used to ordain David as the future king, there would be some respect for Samuel from Saul, but once Samuel dead, all stops are pulled out. It's a free-for-all for Saul to come at David. That may be why this is described here. It says, the Israelites gathered together and lamented for him and buried him at his home in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. So it explains how David got to this very southern portion of Judea, which would border on these Arab areas where he would basically hide in this wilderness, this vast area where people would graze their sheep and their goats. Most didn't have cows the way we think of cattle, but sheep and goats would have been the main livestock there. So David is down there, and he probably went down that way to get as far away from Saul and still live in Judean territory as he possibly could. So we learn right away in verse 2, maybe our first lesson, at least one I've drawn out of here. You might draw other ones as well, but this is one that seems to be very true. Wealth is not necessarily related to righteousness. It was common in the ancient world to assume in Israel that if you were wealthy, God must be pleased with you. You must be doing what God wants. God is obviously blessing you. Wealth is not necessarily related to either righteousness or blessings. Wealth is not related necessarily to blessings. Wealth can come in a number of ways. Wealth can come through underhanded, dirty, rotten cheating. Witness the world around us. And yet there are those who have wealth and they are righteous as well. The two are not necessarily related. 1 Samuel chapter 25 and verse 2. Now there was a man in Maon. So David's down in the wilderness of Paran. One of the areas of Paran was Maon, whose business was in Carmel, this hilly area to the south. And the man was very rich. I mean, he was very rich. Did not have to do with righteousness. He was a shrewd businessman. He had a place, I think, in Carmel called Nabal Tower. No, I'm kidding. I don't know that he had that. I shouldn't say those things. But the point was, he was very wealthy. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. That's wealth. Wealth had to do with the land, with livestock. 3,000 sheep. That's kind of like New Zealand rich today. I've always pictured Nabal with big lamb chops growing on the side of it. Maybe not. Nonetheless, he had a lot of money. And, end of verse 2, he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. So once a year, usually, in the spring after the long winter and after the wool had grown, then was shearing time. And it wasn't just shearing sheep, it was a festival, in essence. And they would slaughter some of the sheep, and they would have, in essence, a party around all this. Because now here, all the hard work of tending these sheep over the course of time is going to pay off, because we're going to shear these sheep, we're going to sell the wool, we're going to make a good amount of money. And he certainly had the operation down. Gathered all the sheep there, took the wool, and then began to market it from there, apparently. Verse 3, the name of the man was Nabal. And again, the word means either fool or stupid. And again, to name your child fool or stupid, something had to be wrong with those parents. Now again, my guess is maybe it's a nickname over the course of time that came about. You probably heard nicknames like that. But nonetheless, he was called fool. The name of his wife was Abigail, and she was a woman of good understanding. Pause for a second. If God's saying she was a woman of good understanding, what does that make Nabal? See, it's contrasting the two of these characters. She's one of good understanding, meaning what? He has no understanding when it comes to some things. Now, did he know how to make money? Without a doubt. He was good at it. But did he have understanding? No. When it comes to life, making money and understanding life can be two different things. She was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance. And he, the man, was harsh and evil in his doings. So in this case, wealth was not at all related to righteousness. Wealth, in this case, was related to doing evil. So he was a shyster. He knew how to take advantage of people. He knew how to cheat people. He knew how to steal from people. Oh, it might have been legal, but it was still stealing. And Christians to this day struggle sometimes with what is legal and what is moral, because not everything that is legal is moral or is right? Oh, I can do this, but is it morally right before God? The government allows this, but is it morally right? So Christians to this day work through those issues the best that they can, striving to be both legal and moral along the way. So here we have fool, harsh and evil. Then it says he was of the house of Caleb. We'll get to that in a moment. I'd like you to turn, put your marker here. We're going to come back to 1 Samuel 25 because it's the only part of the Bible that Nabal is discussed in. And let's look at Psalm 14 in verse 1. Psalm 14 in verse 1. Let's look at this word Nabal. What might have Nabal been like based upon some of these scriptures? I'm not saying Nabal thought this way, but the same word is used. Psalm 14 and verse 1, the Nabal, the fool, the Nabal, has said in his heart, there is no God. Now I'm not saying that the Nabal did not believe in God at all. But to be evil and churlish, as the saying is, or harsh, he must have acted as if he was not accountable to God. This is why we said Christians struggle with what's legal and moral, because we know we're accountable not to the U.S. government, we're accountable to God. So we want to be sure that what we're doing is right. So if other employees on the job get away with certain things, and it seems to be okay, often it's not okay for a Christian because it's not morally right. Oh yeah, we can work 5 out of 8 hours and get away with it, but is that morally right? Well, no, obviously it wouldn't be. So the fool, the Nabal, has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. That's what Nabal was. He was corrupt. They have done abominable works. He was evil. He was a thief. He was a stealer. He took advantage of people. He pressed people. There is none who does good. What is God looking for? The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. Looking for just the opposite. So it may be that Nabal was evil. Maybe he didn't believe in God. Maybe he didn't, certainly wasn't accountable to God. If you look up the word Nabal, it means stupid. But it can also mean wicked, especially impious. So for this man to be called Nabal, he was likely like the one described here in Psalm 14, verse 1. Either he didn't believe in God or certainly didn't believe he was accountable to God. You can get away with whatever you can get away with. So it can be translated vile person. The vile person has said in his heart, there is no God. Let's go back to 1 Samuel chapter 25. We mentioned here that it says this man Nabal was harsh and evil. The word for evil, of course, is ra, the typical word for evil. But it says he was harsh. In the King James, I love the word used to translate there, rather than the New King James. Harsh is okay. The King James Version says churlish. Churlish is not a word we use very often. But it means severe, so it can be harsh. But it can mean churlish, cruel, grievous, hard-hearted, heavy, impudent, obstinate, rough, stubborn. You get a sense of what Nabal was like. This is not the guy you would want as your next door neighbor. This is not the guy you go have a beer with and chit chat with at the end of a long day. This is a guy you stay away from as much as you possibly can. Now, churlish is a word that we kind of have a feel for, and yet it's helpful to look up the dictionary definition. Churlish means marked by a lack of civility or graciousness. A lack of civility or graciousness. Continues on, difficult to work with or deal with. So people who had to deal with Nabal was like, ah, I got to have this wool, but I got to deal with Nabal. Ay, ay, ay. Is there anybody else we can buy wool from down here? I have to work with this guy. Difficult to work with. Another definition of churlish is intractable. Just stubborn, difficult to work with. A churl, if you were to look that up, is a rude, ill-bred person. So you're getting a feel for Nabal. Rude, ill-bred person. So we would say he was not a churl of great price. He was the opposite. A churl. Okay, that was a play on scripture in the New Testament. Never mind. The pearl of great price, he was not a churl of great price. A rude, difficult to work with, ill-bred, childish kind of individual. Sad to see. Hold again your spot here. We'll go to Ezekiel chapter 2. Same word is used here to describe Israel. So again, we want to get a good feel for what this individual is like. Ezekiel chapter 2 and verse 4. This churlish, harsh, hard exterior. I'm sure people said about him, well, he's a good negotiator. Well, it's impossible to work with. Ezekiel chapter 2 and verse 4, describing Israel. For they are impudent. There's that word, harsh, stubborn, cruel, churlish. They're impudent and stubborn children. I'm sending you to them, God says. Ezekiel, you got to go to them, and you shall say to them, thus says the eternal God. Impudent. Impudent, if you look it up in the English dictionary, means marked by contemptuous or cocky boldness or disregard of others. Insolent. Now, again, we look at our Christian lives and we ask, boy, is that how God wants us to be known? Contemptuous or cocky boldness? Disregard of others, dismissing others. Turn over a page, Ezekiel 3 and verse 7. Ezekiel 3 and verse 7, but the house of Israel will not listen to you because they will not listen to me. For all the house of Israel are impudent. In other words, contemptuous of God. No doubt, the same description as we read about Nabal. Contemptuous toward God. Not having to answer to God. So you do as you want. Whatever floats your boat. Whatever gets you what you want the most of. It's the kind of individual here. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted. Now let's go back again to 1 Samuel chapter 25 and pick up the last part of verse 3. It says, he was of the house of Caleb. Now, it's an interesting phrase, two possible explanations. The King James and New King James have taken the approach that the only words literally in the Hebrew is he, Caleb, was of the house of, is felt to be implied. In other words, the King James and the New King James translators felt that this was a phrase or a statement that was identifying his heritage, that he came from as a descendant from Caleb. And yet that may be the case. If that's what was intended, then it's meant to be a contrast. That here's this harsh and evil and impudent and impossible to work with character. Doesn't make sense because he was of the house of Caleb. Who was Caleb? It was Caleb and Joshua, the only faithful messengers who trusted God after spying out the land, that said, God will give us this land. We need to go into it and take it over. God will give it to us. So that may be the case. It may be contrasting Nabal's attitude with Caleb's attitude. But there is another interesting approach to this scripture as well. Caleb literally means dog. That's what Caleb's name means. Yo, dog. So here he is. Now, again, that's not unusual. We would say, well, he was a bulldog for God's way of life. Okay, well, that means he's tenacious and things like that. That undoubtedly was the implication toward the original Caleb. But some translators simply feel that Caleb is a name, but then Caleb is this word that means dog. So they may have been referring to Nabal as simply he was a dog. It's like a snappish dog. One translation actually puts it that way. He was snappish as a dog is the way one translation puts it. So you deal with this guy, he's like this barking dog, always growling and impossible to work with. That may be what is being intended here. Now it's again interesting in verse 3 that Abigail is listed first. It says she's a woman of good understanding. So you have this unbelievable contrast between husband and wife, that she has good understanding, meaning prudence, insight, understanding, good sense, which is fascinating. She didn't have particularly good sense in marrying this character, but that was probably arranged by their families. She didn't probably have any choice in that. And the parents probably felt, yeah, he's an idiot, but he's rich. So suck it up and, you know, you'll be fine. Maybe that's their thought. Who knows? But it also says she was beautiful in appearance. She was beautiful on the inside and pleasant to look at as well. So she was a beautiful person. And again, I think there's some instruction there for all of us, and especially our women, is to be sure to keep this in order. Notice what's listed first. She's a woman of good understanding, and oh yeah, she's a beautiful appearance as well. But what was most important was the character, then the physical things later on. Leads us to a second lesson as we read through, and that is, show appreciation. Show appreciation. That's what I learned from this. Verse 4, when David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. Again, that's a time of festival. It's a time of counting how much, in essence, you've been able to make. And then you've when the paycheck comes in, it's a happy time. So they would often have a large feast at that time. So when David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, David sent 10 young men. And David said to the young men, go up to Carmel, to Nabal, and greet him in my name. Tell him who you're representing. And thus you shall say to him who lives in prosperity, peace be to you, peace to your house, and peace to all that you have. Why would he start out with 3 greetings of peace? Because David had 600 men in his army, and he could have taken whatever he wanted. But this was a fellow Israelite, a Jew, and so he certainly wouldn't take in that regard at all, wouldn't steal from them. So he wanted to reassure them this was not a military conquest, so sending these young men to ask a request. Now, what right did David have to ask? Verse 7, now I've heard that you have shearers. Your shepherds were with us. So we mentioned that this was in the south part of Judea, near the Arabian wilderness. Raiding parties could very easily and often would cross the border, steal and kill and take and go back home. So with David's army, they were, yes, hiding in the wilderness, but what were they doing while they were there? They were protecting Israelite or Jewish property by their swords, in essence. So the shepherds had shepherd's crooks. They didn't have swords and spears. So David's men provided the military protection for fellow Israelites, free of charge. They weren't charging for it. David says, I've heard your shearers, they're there. They're making they're cashing in, we might say. Your shepherds were with us, and we did not hurt them, nor was there anything missing from them all the while they were in Carmel. This was our area. You brought your flocks into this area. We let them graze. We protected them. We didn't steal a single sheep. We didn't didn't intimidate any of the shepherds. So verse 8, ask your young men, and they will tell you. In other words, we were honest in every dealing. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes. We'd love to have a gift. For we come on a feast day, this party, cash day, we might say, payday. Please give whatever comes to your hand to your servants and to your son David. David was ordained the future king of Israel, but he humbly makes this request to help sustain us while we're in this circumstance. And he calls himself your son David. He doesn't say your king, your general, general of the army. He simply says your son. So David was making this humble request for some sustenance. And again, as we said, at the lamb's shearing, there was a great feast that went on as well. It would last for quite some time. It takes a long time to shear 300 sheep with scissors, in essence. They didn't have the kind of shearers that we do today. Wah, wah, and, you know, in 5 minutes, you got a sheep done. These are, you know, clippers. It takes a while to do this. Knives and clippers and things like that. It's a challenge. It's a hard work. So it was not an unreasonable request. Now, when you think about Nabal here having 3,000 sheep, if he were to give David 30 sheep, what percentage of that flock would that be? It's 1%. Give 30 sheep. If it's 60 sheep, it's 2%, if my math is right. He could give him 100 sheep, and it'd be 4 or 5% of his giant flock. Would it put him out to do that? Why was his flock so large? One of the reasons was David's men protected it all year long while they were grazing. Didn't lose one shepherd, didn't lose a single sheep. So could he have spared 30, 50, 100 sheep without blinking an eye? But when you are churlish and selfish and impossible to deal with, you don't do it that way. You don't think of it that way. So show appreciation. Important to do. Nabal should have done that. Verse 9, another lesson may be here. Be careful with your words. Be careful with your words. That's a constant lesson, just like showing appreciation. Verse 9, so when David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in the name of David and waited. Kind of sat there, waited for an answer. Then Nabal answered David's servants and said, Who is David? Talk about an insult. Talk about a churlish man, impossible to work with, stubborn, impudent. Who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? Like, who is he? So what? There are many servants nowadays who break away each one from his master. That probably wasn't true, but he's now not just saying no, he's insulting David. Did he break away from his master? Well, no, he wasn't a slave, number one. He didn't break away from his master. His master tried to pin him to a wall with a spear and tried to murder him, sent armies out after him. It's a little bit different story, you Yahoo. But he's just being insulting. Like, I'm the man. Got all my stuff here. Big payday. He's counting the dollars. Add to his coffers, add to his wealth, add to his influence. So he's insulting David. Verse 11. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men whom I do not know where they are from? Again, was that true? No. He knew exactly who David was. He knew who David's men were. He knew where they were from. He knew why they were there. And yet he was unappreciative of the gifts that David had given in protection during that period of time. So be careful with your words. Words have meaning. When we talk with each other as husbands and wives, it's important to remember words carry meaning. And so we can say something harsh and say, well, I didn't really mean that. Well, it's too late. The harshness is out. Words have meanings. I can sit in people's living rooms decades later and they can recount to me when my husband said this or my wife said that. Words carry meaning. So when Nabal says, who's David? I don't know this guy. I'm going to give him my stuff? I don't think so. Stubborn, impudent individual. It would have been Nabal's benefit to read James chapter 3 about the tongue and how it is an unruly evil. And how it can set on fire a whole forest. It would have been good for him to read James. Of course, it hadn't been written yet. But it would have been good for him. Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 16. I'll read it to you. Proverbs 14 verse 16. A wise man fears and departs from evil. But a Nabal rages and is self-confident. Pretty much describes a fool rages and is self-confident. Nabal rages here and is confident that nothing could ever happen to him. Because of his wealth, because of his stubbornness, he had no concern about this at all. Be careful with your words. Words carry meaning. And these words were very insulting. He couldn't say later on, well, I didn't mean that, because he meant every word of it. Fourth lesson. Our first reaction is not always our best reaction. Our first reaction is not always our best reaction. Now, yours might be. Oftentimes, mine is not. And that's why we hold our tongue and allow God's Spirit time to influence what we may be about to say. Our first reaction is not always our best reaction. Now, someday, we hope to be like God the Father in Jesus Christ when our first reaction is always perfect. Wouldn't that be a great thing? Verse 12. David's young men turned on their heels and went back. That's a phrase that in essence means they stomped out of there. They were mad. And they rightly so. They'd been insulted. Like, we're coming here as beggars? I don't think so. They turned on their heels and they went back. And they came and told him all these words. Here's what the guy said. What's David's first reaction? We're going to go kill him, every single one of them. A man like that does not deserve to live. I would say it was a bit of a harsh reaction, wouldn't you say? Strap on your sword, boys. We're going to go kill these people. David said to his men, every man gird on his sword. So every man girded on his sword. So the party went out. Hundreds of soldiers. And David also girded on his sword. He was going to lead them. And about 400 men went with David. And 200 stayed with the supplies. And I'll bet the 200 who stayed behind were angry at that. How come we got to sit with the stuff and they get to go get into the battle? David's first reaction was a bad reaction. But it shows us there were at least 600 soldiers in David's battle group, we might say. As he roamed in the wilderness, more and more people were coming to him over the course of time, dissatisfied with Saul and his craziness and what he was doing. Was getting larger and larger. First reaction, not a good reaction. It was rash on David's part to decide to murder Nabal and all the men, all the males in the entire camp were going to be destroyed. That meant his kids, his grandkids, if he had any, his servants, his shearers, his shepherds, they were all going to go. And David was just going to take the 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. Why? Because he'd been insulted. It's easy to react irrationally when we've been insulted, when our pride has been hurt. And David's pride was hurt here. So, thankfully, he didn't carry out that first thought, that first reaction. But we'll see what happened. It leads us to lesson number 5, we might say. When you see wrong, get help. When you see wrong, get help. We each have a responsibility to identify wrong in appropriate circumstances and take it to the place where help can be gotten. Verse 14, now one of the young men told Abigail. So picture the scenario. Here's this servant standing there, kind of holding the tray, while Nabal just spits insults at these young men. And he's kind of going, you've got to be kidding me. Does he know who these people are? Does he know who David is? He has just signed all of our death warrants. Now, you'd think, okay, well, you know, that's the way it is. He's the boss. No, it's wrong. You got to say something. You cannot allow that. So what could he do? He went to the person who had good understanding, who had prudence, who had insight, who had good sense. Nabal's wife, Abigail. So one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he reviled them. He spat on them, in essence. He turned them away. But the men, verse 15, were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything as long as we accompanied them when we were in the fields. So now we really understand what happened. It's not that David wandered into the area and said, look, I'll provide protection. The shepherds took all the sheep to the area where David's men were because it would be safe. We benefited greatly by these men being here. They didn't take a thing. And here's what Nabal does. He spits on them. And it says that I'm not providing a thing. David is a man of war. He has killed hundreds. You don't insult a man like that with his soldiers. Verse 16. They were a wall to us both night and day. All the time we were with them keeping the sheep. Like a wall, they protected us. They watched over us. Now therefore, know and consider what you will do. For harm is determined against our master and against all his household. You see, when those young men spun on their heels, this guy knew we're as good as dead. You don't insult people like that. These are David's ambassadors, his right-hand men. You don't do that to these people. When they gave us such good, you don't treat them like that. So he says, I know what's coming. So here you have a servant, had good sense. Harm is determined against our master and against all his household, for he is such a scoundrel that one cannot speak to him. It was true. So it doesn't matter who is wrong, it must be addressed. If the boss is sinning, it needs to be addressed. If you are aware of others who are doing evil or wrong things, get them some help. Don't be silent. Somehow this thought of being silent when others are suffering or doing horrible things is somehow honorable. It's just not. The word scoundrel here literally means son of Belial. He is such a son of the devil. That's what he's saying. That one cannot speak to him. You can't talk to this guy without him saying something foolish and stupid. He's lucky he didn't have Twitter back then. Verse 18 teaches us another lesson. Quick, righteous action bears fruit. Quick, righteous action bears fruit. Then Abigail, because she was a woman of understanding, great understanding, insight, Abigail made haste. She realized this young man, this servant, was absolutely right. And if she didn't do something right now, they would all be dead, at least all the males. Abigail made haste, took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine. Do you just like to have this in your pantry? No, this is again a time of celebration. They had all these things right there on hand. 3,000 sheep, it takes a while to shear them, and a group of people, a large group of employees are taking care of this. They had all kinds of supplies they could spare. It was not like this was taking everything that they had to eat. 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys. I mean, she was on the spot. Boom, 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 get this done. So she was very familiar with the running of this household. She knew exactly what was there, what they could spare, what needed to be done, so as to save the lives of everyone there. She said to her servants, "Go on before me. See, I am coming after you. You start, I'll be right behind you." In other words, she wanted the gift to arrive first, and then she would arrive to explain the gift. Shrewd, sharp, intelligent woman. "Go on before me. See, I'm coming after you." But she did not tell her husband, "Fool." That was good insight. Good insight. In this case, he had just signed their death warrant. To fight with him at this point would have been foolishness. There was not time to fight it out with him, because that's what it was going to be. It would be a fight. So it was, verse 20, "As she rode on the donkey, that she went down under the cover of the hill. And there were David and his men coming down toward her, and she met them." She herself went. The fool's wife risked her own life to spare the lives of everybody back at the camp. An honorable thing to do, and it would bear fruit. Now, David had said, what did he tell his fellows as they're strapping on their swords? David had said to them at that point, "Surely in vain I have protected all that this fellow has in the wilderness. We worked all year long to serve and to help. It was a waste of time. So that nothing was missed of all that belongs to him. And he has repaid me evil for good." Didn't support me, but just insulted me as well. To his first reaction, "We're just going to kill them all. May God do so." Here's David's words. "May God do so and more also to the enemies of David, if I leave one male of all who belongs to him by morning light." He was going to slay every single man in the encampment. That's what he said. That's what was coming. And they were angry. Verse 23. "Now when Abigail saw David, she dismounted quickly from the donkey, fell on her face before David, and bowed down to the ground." Again, a woman of tremendous insight. We learn another lesson, maybe number 7. Strive to craft soothing words. Strive to craft soothing words. When there's upset, when there's harshness, when emotions rage or are high, Christians strive to craft soothing words. Oh, we don't pretend that the situation doesn't exist, but we try, as one of the Proverbs says, to pour oil on troubled waters. Smooth things out. Pour oil on troubled waters. Calm things down. Again, words carry meaning. And we strive to craft soothing words so that we can get to the issue and drain some of the emotion from the situation. Abigail gives words of good sense, of smoothness, soothingness. Abigail saw David dismounted, fell on the ground, verse 24. So she fell at his feet and said, "On me, my Lord, on me, let this iniquity be." And she probably meant that. She probably would rather have been killed herself than to see everyone back at the camp destroyed, at least all the males. Senseless slaughter. Now, she very well may have meant that. Now, she may have also been a gambler and said, "He's less likely to kill me than he is my husband." That Yahoo put us in the middle of this mess. Maybe that was the case. But as she said, "And please let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant." Interesting, her approach. I've known some wealthy women that have this heart. I've known other wealthy women who are just as churlish as Nabal, who flaunt their position and their wealth and their supposed superiority over others. It's a sad situation. She was willingly off the donkey, at his feet, making the request, "Please listen to what I have to say. Please hear your maidservant." Verse 25. "Please let not my Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him." Now that's pretty harsh to call your husband, you know, he is a fool. It's his name, it's what he acts like. How could she have said anything different? She couldn't have said, "Well, he didn't really mean that, because he meant every word of it." That would be a lie. Now, this is a little bit insulting, but it was true. And if she's going to spare the lives of everyone back there, she had to tell it like it was. "He is a fool. He did something foolish." Now, normally I don't recommend wives telling other people, "You know, my husband's a real fool." I hope we don't, men, give our wives occasion to be tempted to say those things to others. But she nailed it. He was a fool. And she had to say that to David, because to say anything else would have been insincere. To say, "We really do like you. He really wants to help out, but he had indigestion last night and he wasn't feeling real well when the guys came." And it's baloney. He's a fool. He said stupid things, but please take it out on me. Don't take it out on everybody there. A pretty brilliant approach. Continues on. "But I," rest of verse 25, "your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent." That was certainly true. I didn't know they were there. "Had I known, things would have been different." That's what she was saying. So in verse 26, "Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, since the Eternal has held you back from coming to bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hand." You see, everybody was familiar with the fact that David did not raise his hand against Saul. He had opportunity to slaughter Saul, to murder him. But David would not do it on several occasions. Those stories spread like wildfire. And she said, "Look, you've held back from avenging yourself. Who's insulted you more than Saul himself? Who's given away your wife to somebody else? The one that he promised to you." Wow. "So you've held yourself back from coming to bloodshed, from avenging yourself with your own hand. Now then, let your enemies and those who seek harm for my Lord be as Nabal." Interesting. She says, he's kind of turned himself into an enemy to you. And that's not right. So let God take care of it. That's what she's saying. You didn't take this into your own hand before. Don't do it now. Pretty intelligent. "And now, "This present which your maidservant has brought to my Lord, let it be given to the young men who follow my Lord." Give them a couple loaves of bread, some raisins, that'll settle them down a little bit. That's kind of what she's saying. Please give it to them. We really want them to have it. We want to heal this whole thing. So she gives advice carefully and wisely, crafts soothing words. "Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant." Like it wasn't her fault, but she's taking it on because she knows that he will be more amiable. And now, no harsh words here. Wise, soothing words. True, but soothing. Verse 28. "Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant. For the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord fights the battles of the Lord, and evil is not found in you throughout your days." She's not saying, you know, it'd be a terrible mistake for you to kill anybody here. You'd be disobeying God. You'd be taking this into your own hands, and you've never done that. Don't do this. No. She's saying, you've always been fighting God's battles. God will continue to fight your battles. In other words, let it go. Verse 29. "Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life," that's Saul, "but the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the eternal your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the pocket of a sling." Pretty intelligent. What's she referring to? The old Goliath story, right? In the same way you threw out death, God will take care of your enemies in the same way. God will take care of them. If Nabal needs to die, God will take care of that. Don't do it yourself. "It shall come to pass when the Eternal has done for my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you ruler over Israel." They knew all this. Nabal knew all this. "That this will be no grief to you." You won't have to look back on this and say, "What a foolish thing I did. I slaughtered innocent people because one fool insulted me." That'd be a heavy load to carry. And so she understood that. What a wise woman. "There will be no grief to you, nor offense of heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause, or that my Lord has avenged himself. But when the Eternal has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant." I'm at your disposal. I'm your servant. Verse 32. David said to Abigail, "Blessed is the eternal God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me." David recognized the wisdom of this advice. It soothed him. And he said, "God has sent you here so that I don't do something stupid. You know, my testosterone got the best of me here. And the manly stuff, I'm going to kill these guys insulting me. Blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and avenging myself with my own hand. I recognize it with Saul all the time. I didn't get it here. Now I do. For indeed, as the eternal God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, surely by this morning light, no males would have been left to Nabal." I would have gone through with it. In a rage. Verse 35. "So David received from her hand what she had brought him and said to her, 'Go up in peace to your house. See, I have heeded your voice and respected your person.'" He was impressed with her. It's interesting that David lived what Proverbs 9 verse 8 says. "Do not correct a scoffer lest he hate you, but rebuke a wise man and he will love you." Rebuke a wise man and he will love you. That's what David did. He was rebuked in a gentle way by her statements. And he would love her all the more and eventually take her to be his wife. Last but not least, our final lesson, you reap what you sow. You reap what you sow. That's pretty obvious. Abigail went to Nabal, and there he was, holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. Wealthy, wealthy man. Here he is, wholly drunk, with no concept that death was minutes away from him and every other male in the encampment. Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. Therefore, she told him nothing, little or much, until morning light. Sleep it off, and I'll tell you how close you were to killing us all. Verse 37. So it was in the morning, when the wine had gone from Nabal, and his wife had told him these things, that his heart died within him, and he became like a stone. I mean, she told him, we just about died. I had to meet the guy in the valley just over the hill here with 400 soldiers that were going to kill every single one of us, at least all the men, because of your foolish words. Now, it says his heart died within him and he became a stone. So some sort of heart attack, maybe literally in this case. The fear and the fright of what he had just about done to everyone there. He stressed out. He had a heart attack, apparently. Then it happened, verse 38. Then it happened after about 10 days that the Eternal struck Nabal, and he died. You do reap what you sow. You can only be churlish for so long. You can only be harsh for so long. You can only be evil for so long. You can only cheat people for so long. Eventually, you will pay the price in this life or the next. You do reap what you sow. Galatians does tell us God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, that will he also reap. We eventually pay the piper. Verse 39, so when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be the Eternal who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal. Exactly what the woman had said. Let God take care of this. And David says, God did. God took care of the insult. I didn't have to. Great life lesson for David. He didn't have to return insult for insult. He knew God would take care of that. He didn't at first, but he got it. It would be a great lesson for him later on when he was fleeing from Jerusalem. And there was an individual throwing stones and yelling curses at him. What did he tell his men? Let God take care of that Bethlehemite. Let God take care of him. Don't you kill him. Don't put your hand on him. God will take care of that. So he learned that lesson. He's kept his servant from evil, for the Eternal has returned the wickedness of Nabal on his own head. And David sent and proposed to Abigail to take her as his wife. And of course he did. So, brethren, the story of Nabal is a sad story in many respects, but a great line of lessons for all of us. As we study the scripture to learn the lessons, let's do our part to learn and then apply lessons from the life of the big fool.